Welcome to Longevity. I'm your host, Natalie Nittam. I'm a nutritionist, a human potential and epigenetic coach, and I created this podcast to bring you the latest ways to take control of your health and longevity. We cover it all, from new technology and ancestral health practices to personalized interventions and a very special interest of mine, peptides and bioregulators. Enjoy the show. Hi, welcome back. I'm Natalie Nittam, your host. There's a reason so many people today feel overwhelmed, anxious, or just off. And according to today's guest, it might actually be starting with your vision. Dr. Meenal Agarwal joins me to explain how the way we use our eyes, especially with screens, can affect everything from emotional regulation to cognitive performance. We talk about the hidden link between vision and things like ADHD diagnoses, why peripheral vision matters more than you think, and how small daily habits can actually help to retrain your brain. This is one of those conversations that makes you look at your everyday life a little differently. Literally, pun intended. All right, before we jump in, I'm going to thank a couple of sponsors that make this episode possible, and then we get to jump in. Think about that time when your gut feels off. Travel leaves you bloated and sluggish, diet changes cause discomfort, hard workouts throw off digestion, or recovery from stress just takes too long. What's actually happening in there? These everyday stressors challenge your gut lining. When that barrier weakens, digestion suffers, and so does your energy, immune balance, and resilience. Now, this is why Level Up Health created Ultimate GI Repair. Inside each capsule, you will find four next-generation peptides: BPC-157 to signal repair, lorazepam to protect tight junctions, KPV to calm local inflammation, and GHK copper to support tissue remodeling. The formula also includes zinc L-carnosine for mucosal stability, tributyrin to deliver butyrate fuel, and dual-form quercetin to modulate histamine and immune activity. Every ingredient is buffered for absorption, third-party verified, and tested above 99% purity. Now, for short-term gut recovery or long-term resilience, Ultimate GI Repair brings everything together in one clean, research-based capsule. To get your hands on a bottle for yourself, go to leveluphealth.com and make sure to use code NAT for 20% off. That's LVLUPhealth.com and use code NAT. Are you dealing with mold, heavy metals, hormone disruptors, or other toxins? Well, I got news for you. If you're living in the modern world, you probably are, at least to some degree. Never present a problem without a solution, and I have a very simple one for you. Take a humic mineral complex. Humic is a powerful adsorbent. It travels through your system and attracts toxins like a magnet. It binds and neutralizes them and then carries them out of your system for good. A 2023 study found that humic binds 7 to 10 times more toxins than activated charcoal, making it one of the most effective detoxifiers in the world. And if you're struggling to detox from those heavy metals, mold and mycotoxins, persistent organic pollutants, hormone disruptors, or pesticides like glyphosate, you got to try this stuff. You will feel it working within days. It's actually even good for hangovers. Now, my favorite humic complex is MicroBoost from Beam Minerals. It's a concentrated liquid. All you have to do is take a shot of it each morning or even at night before bed. It's actually quite good for sleep. MicroBoost tastes like water and starts working within minutes. It's a simple, effective way to remove those toxins fast. Now, I have a very special discount code for my listeners. That's you. So if you want to get rid of toxins for good, head to beamminerals.com, use code NAT20 and get 20% off your first order. Meenal Agarwal, welcome to the show. I feel like we probably should have done this in person, but it is so excited to, it's so exciting to have you here today.
Oh my God. Thank you so much, Natalie, for having me. It's such an honor.
Oh, well, it's mutual. And literally, guys, we are both, you know, at least on paper, we're both in Toronto. I mean, Meenal is definitely north of me, but we're both living through the same ice
storm.
Storm thing that she's banished her children outside into because they got a snow or an ice.
We got to do what we got to do, Natalie.
So we're going to have to keep this train moving so that these children don't like end up encased in ice somehow. So we're talking about vision. I know that for many, many people, like the world is separated into two pieces. People who believe the eyes are just the eyes and people who understand that your eyes are an extension of your brain, which really is that concept alone, I think is going to be central to this conversation. So before we jump into all the stuff,
I would love it if you would just speak to that a little bit, because it's such an important positioning statement for the audience to understand that eye health has everything to do with longevity, because either it's a reflection or an expression or an extension of your brain health.
Absolutely. I mean, it's such an underrated concept, right? We don't talk about the eyes at all when we talk about biohacking or longevity. And of course, as an eye doctor, I feel it's the number one thing. When you take it back embryonically, your retina is an extension embryonically of brain tissue.
Wow.
And so it is a direct product of the brain. And of course, vicinity wise, they are close to each other. When we have our retina and our optic nerve go straight to the brain. But when you look at just the brain, 50% of the brain's real estate is processing vision. Like,
you're kidding.
You can Google that. You know, 50% of the brain's areas are used to process vision. So that's a big chunk. And then there's, you know, smaller areas, you know, dedicated 10 to 15% for auditory and then the other senses. But there's a lot of brain space spending time, energy processing vision. And that is why when we see cognitive decline, there's a lot of those patients have vision and or auditory decline.
Yes.
There's a very, you know, I think the stat is 60%, there's studies been done of patients with cognitive decline have some form of vision loss. And that's strong, because if your vision is not good, think about it, your muscles, if you want to call them, in your brain or the areas are working twice as hard to process that vision that it is declining. There is earlier cognitive decline, A, because you're ignoring other areas of the brain because mm-hmm. those areas are overpowered, and B, because they're working so hard that they actually get weaker. So correcting your vision for me is number one. When you are talking about cognitive decline, neuro decline, we think of like, let's take this supplement for cognition. Let's take this. It's like, well, let's just correct our vision, A, and take care of our vision and maybe take those prevention steps to help not have our vision decline.
Yeah. No, that's so powerful, right? And I mean, and if you think about it, it makes sense. There is so much, the volume of information that comes in visually. I mean, 50% is astounding, but from proprioception, like where you are in space, to color, to texture, to movement, to saving your life because you don't want to be in the path of a moving car, to like, you know, if you think about the density of information that is coming in through the eyes, and what's really interesting is when you think about when people lose their vision, how much sharper the other senses become. And is that because the body now reroutes some of that brain power to those other senses so that they become more acute to even be able to start to make up for some of the deficits? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm actually really glad you mentioned, you know, the periphery or the awareness and proprioception, vestibular movement, all those things, because there, you know, there's a whole lobe, you know, dedicated to this in your brain's cortex. The parietal lobe is doing all that work. So when we look at something moving, or, you know, we look at anything, it goes straight through the visual cortex to the parietal area. The stream is called the dorsal visual stream. And then that area talks to all the other areas of the brain, whether it's the amygdala, which is the fear center of our brain. So, you know, when you go into a crowd and you're afraid, that's your, you know, you see all this movement of people mm-hmm. in a crowd. It's talking to your fear center. When you stare at a screen all day and then you get up and you kind of feel like, whoa, give me a second, I'm moving a little bit, that's it talking to your vestibular areas. Wow. Like your visual processing center is talking to every single area of your brain for you to feel, I call it spatial empathy or spatial emotion. Mm-hmm. Looking at how people are talking, looking at, you know, when you go into a crowd and you're like, I don't really like those two people, how you react. And this is all going through the visual cortex,
yeah.
through your, you know, parietal lobe. This is all part of vision. Vision is the number one thing that senses all this. And then there's a whole piece to the circadian rhythm, right? Your body's internal clock starts with your eyes.
Yeah. No, we're going to
start with you waking up and looking at the light, right? Yeah. And that's a big part of it that people, you know, ignore. You know, we purchase all these devices, and it's my biggest pet peeve. and we get it all naturally.
Yeah, it could be free. No, and I mean, the right light at the right time is a conversation that finally is starting to break through. But before we jump into that, let's talk a little. You mentioned screen fatigue a minute ago. You'd mentioned staring at a screen. When did you first realize that it's not just screen fatigue or just dry eyes, but it's something is bigger that's happening to how brains process space? Like, let's talk about that a little bit, because it's just, it's a bigger issue, right? It's screen fatigue is a thing. Dry eye is definitely a thing, but it's, you know, there's a bigger problem here. And so when did it kind of come to you? Like, wait a minute, because you're bucking the system, right? So.
Yeah. I mean, this is a big thing for me. I just wrote a book on it. It's coming out in the fall called Stuck in a Flat World, and how screens are rewiring our brains, spatial awareness, and sense of safety. And, you know, let's break it down scientifically. When you are looking at a screen that is, or anything up close, I don't want to just blame screens, but something up close, if you, screens are entertaining. So you're going to stare at a screen longer than anything else.
Especially these days.
Yeah, that's your central 10 degrees of vision. So that's your foveal vision, we call it, which is your central 10 degrees. Everything else around it, which is a lot more than 10 degrees, is your peripheral area of vision. Your central area of vision is processed through a different lobe in your brain. Your peripheral area is processed through what we call the parietal lobe. So it's the dorsal stream. So when we are constantly stimulating the foveal area, which is your 10 degrees, the rest of it gets underused and it gets weaker. Mm-hmm. And this is why when you are crossing a street while you're texting and you're on your phone, you might miss that car next to you. And that's why, you know, nowadays when you're I'm sure we've all been at that light where a teenager is crossing after high school.
And you want to get out of slap.
And they don't even look up at you. They don't even look up, you know, before we would be all cautious, right? This is why there was a study done. I forget the exact stat. I think it was 40% of teens cite fear as the primary reason to not get their license now. Why are they scared? They're scared because there's movement around them in their space, which is not the central 10 degrees that they're super comfortable with, but it's all that spatial vision where there's traffic, there's other cars that is scaring them, because the moment that gets stimulated, now your parietal lobe areas that have been asleep or not working as effectively send a message to the amygdala. Hey, let's go on high alert because this is weird. She's now waking up this area, and you get scared. And this is why fear is such a big thing now. This is why myself and other people included who used to be extroverts feel like they need to be introverted now, because they can't be around movement or other people. And that makes them a little scared. And to bring you back to the question you initially asked me was, how did I get into this and why did I want to research this? A few years ago, I was off to work due to health reasons. And at my work, we're not on a computer all day, right? I'm seeing patients, I'm back and forth. I don't chart till the end of the day, and I'm so lazy. I tend to like break up my charting. You know, I don't sit for hours on a computer, never been my lifestyle. But I was off work for 2 to 3 months. And that's when my podcast was born. In the 2 to 3 months, I was sitting here and I'm like, I've got to do something with my life. And so I had no idea how to do a podcast, right? So I'm researching like what platform and what do you do? And I had never listened to a podcast in my life, you know? So I'm like trying to get who can help me, what can I do? And I'm on my computer like 13 hours a day, like into the night, because I'm so bored, right? And I'm on it for 2 to 3 months, and lots of things started happening in my life. I started pulling back from friends. You know, friends would invite me for coffee and I'd be like, no, I can't come. I would ask how many people are coming. I would not want to sit on the floor with my kids. My kids would be calling me in the periphery and it would be zoned out. Kind of like when your kids watch TV and you're calling them like, what do you want for dinner? What do you want for dinner? And nobody listens to you. Yeah. It's zoned out, your periphery. Lots of weird things were happening. And then the kicker was for me, my son fell down the stairs and we have a long flight of stairs, and my other two kids came running, like screaming my name to him, like, mom, come down, like, mom. It didn't faze me. My reaction time was delayed. And that's when I realized either I have early cognitive disease. Mm-hmm. I thought I had mold toxicity. I made my husband get everything checked, or I had like a form of, you know, dementia, something was going on, a neuro disease, right?
Yeah.
So I went to my doctor and I'm like, something's happening to me. I think I have early something onset dementia. And, you know, we were going to order an MRI, but in that process, you know, both of us are the type of people that are going to sit there and research everything ourselves. And I realized something that we didn't learn in school was that there is a whole neuro process that is stimulating only certain areas of your brain when you are looking at a screen all day. And I said, and I named this disorder. I classified myself as spatial awareness processing disorder. And I said, I need to get this out there. Because after that, I started noticing it in my patients. There were people that would say, my child can recite dinosaur facts for 30 minutes straight, but can't catch a ball for his life. My child can read a book, but they cannot copy from the board and have that fine motor skill. Children being scared of things, children not wanting to go out. I mean, how many children do we see that are staring at their phone coming, like 12-year-olds coming into my exam chair, staring at the phone? Things were getting worse. And, you know, I had a patient, she was a mother similar to me, had two kids, and she came in crying saying, my anxiety's gotten worse. I don't play with my children anymore. I don't know what's happening. Something's off, and she starts bawling. She thinks it's her prescription that's changed. So we check that. Obviously, nothing's wrong. I check her eye health. All is good. She checked all the boxes to the spatial awareness processing disorder. And I said to her, what has changed in your life in the last bit since you've noticed this anxiety go up? And then it turns out after questioning her, she was working at a golf course. And in the summer, she works at the golf course. The moment the season changes here in Toronto, she's on a computer. And she said, I've been on my computer a lot more now. It's a lot of work right now. And I said, I need you to cut back. And, you know, we talked about a plan and she's feeling so much better. And I said, what you were labeling as anxiety through the roof was your amygdala and your parietal lobe on high alert. Mm-hmm. So I feel this is also why ADHD is going up. Anxiety is going up. We just randomly labeling them as anxiety, but what we're not realizing is what has changed in our lifestyle that is causing all this. There's not a child that you see in their teenage years that is not taking out their phone 24 hours a day. And we don't realize that the retinal cells actually release dopamine as well. So when you're looking at something, it's not only the brain, it's the retinal cells that release dopamine, send that signal to the brain for that rewards. They release more dopamine. And then it's that reward circuit. It's the colors, it's the movement, it's the fascinating stuff on our screens. When we had books, sure, they were flat. They were still, they were close by, but they're not fascinating.
Well, you had to use your imagination, right? Mm-hmm. Like you had to envision, like I remember as a kid, I was a voracious reader. You had to see in your mind's eye, and which is why sometimes when you went to see the movie, it didn't deliver because you're like, no, that's not what that person looks like. Anyway, but I digress. But that is, you know, and I would say, it's not just the teenagers. What freaks me out is the little people, the 2-year-olds and the 3-year-olds and the 4-year-olds. And I've done a couple of podcasts, not from the lens, pardon the pun, of vision, but the lens of brain development, which, by the way, as you've just said, is intricately tied to vision. But it's at the point now where, and you see this a lot at the airports, right? You see these little tiny kids in strollers, airports, restaurants, glued to screens. And the rewiring of these children's brain that is happening, I think it should be nothing short of terrifying to every one of us.
But you know, Natalie, I think about it and I'm like, listen, let's be practical. I'm a mom. I give my kids a phone when, you know, we have to go out for dinner and everybody's like going crazy on me and I need a minute. We all do it. And I think that's just part of life. And this is the new wave. But, you know, I always say reserve it for those times of need.
Exactly.
So like, on the airplane, I hand it to them. You know, we're at a restaurant. Sometimes I have to give it. But at home, or if we're just going on a car ride, like all of us, you don't have to hand them that. Those are moments where they could be screaming. Let them scream, right?
You I mean, we just locked your children out in a snowstorm.
So let them scream. Let them, you know, be cold. It's part of life. We all did. We used to walk home in the cold.
Yeah. 10 miles.
But, you know, absolutely. You know, when we're in a car, it's easy to hand them something. And there are two car games that are simple that we used to play when we were young. And they're so good for brain development. The I Spy.
Yeah.
Right. They're looking around using their periphery and follow that car. And follow that car is you pick a car ahead of you and you say, okay, follow that red car. Tell us where you think it's going. Tell us when you think it's going to take a left turn. What do you think is happening? You know, make up a story. Use your imagination. Use that parietal lobe.
Brilliant.
Develop that periphery, right? You can talk to your kids, but we are also guilty of being on the phone in the car. Mm-hmm. So then we don't have the capacity to talk to our children. Yeah. So pick and choose. It's all about balance. It's just, you can't be on a phone all the time. And I had a four-year-old, you know, you mentioned the little ones. Parents brought her in for an eye exam. She was a minus six.
Oh my God.
I don't think I've seen that in my career of 20 years with a four-year-old being a minus six. Both parents have no prescription, not much of a history of anything crazy. Parents are like, you know, you're lying to us. Like, how could this happen? I'm like, just tell me about her life. Like, do you both work? Where do you work? What's happening? What does she do all day? Is she in school? Like, what's happening? They work from home and they give her an iPad the entire day. Mm. And I said, no, like you're joking, right? Like 1 hour, 2 hours, but then you, no, we give it to her 8 hours a day.
So her muscles have spasmed into like, they can't move. They've paralyzed.
So, and near work, excess near work is a trigger of nearsightedness, yeah. Right? Based on, you know, the eyeball length actually triggers or signals that are sent to elongate. So you need a higher prescription. And the scary part is that the stat that we are ahead of trend is 2050, 50% of the world will be nearsighted.
Because of screens. Probably.
That's one of the biggest culprits.
Probably. Yeah. That's crazy. Wow. You're blowing my mind right now. And because, you know, we all know at a gut level, and in that four-year-old, before we move on, is it reversible, do you think?
Yeah. So, I mean, listen, you'll see everybody online talk about reversing things. We're not going to talk about reversing, but the minus four is something so strong. That's from her eyeball length. Something that high of a prescription, we can't reverse the whole thing. That's based on her eyeball length. But what our goal is to prevent progression, because a minus four will tend to progress. So there are many ways that we can kind of trick the brain through myopia control glasses, myopia control contacts, atropine drops, where we can control and trick the brain into when you're looking up close, it's actually far, such that your prescription doesn't worsen. But you will see, you know, a lot of people talk about hacks of improving vision, and there are exercises that we can do, mm-hmm. vision therapy training and exercises that can help reduce the prescription a little bit, maybe a quarter, maybe 0.5. But is in the bigger picture, is a minus four really going to reverse all the way? No, vision therapy doesn't do that. Vision therapy is for relaxing the muscles and helping training the muscles. So whatever component of that minus four is from over-focusing a little will relax and will get rid of that bit of a prescription. Typically, that's averages about a 0.5.
Yeah.
We're not going to see a full minus four reverse completely.
Well, you know, I think what'll be interesting for you, and I don't know how long you've been seeing this child and if she's been back and how able her parents have been to change the behavior, because they have two problems, right? So there's a physical problem that showed up in this child's eyes, but there's a behavioral issue where she's not going to want to lose that iPad, right? There's a whole narrative out there about how these children become addicted to the screens for the dopamine reason that you cited earlier. So they have a big issue on their hands. But let's say they convince her to work, to play with blocks and dolls and art and trucks and whatever they can get her hands on, which would require them to bring another human into the house to help to engage her in some degree.
Yeah, yeah.
And no judgment, you know, like they're doing the best they can.
That's part
they're
of
both working.
Yeah.
Like I don't want to sound unsympathetic to them, but at some level, it would be interesting if they were really able to get her off the screen. As a four-year-old, the brain's more plastic. Things are more, mm-hmm. maybe maybe they could see a gain of one. Like, who knows, right? Like,
yeah. It would be so fascinating. I'll tell you, I have been seeing her back, and she is still on the iPad. I can tell you that. And, you know, I am sympathetic towards them, exactly what you said. I mean, they have no help. They're immigrants. You have to work to sustain a life here. We're in Toronto. Everything's high priced here. You know, to be able to survive, both parents need to work. So I get it. And so my job then is, if that can't change, what are the methods that I can use to control her? So we have actually kind of double whammied her, putting her into myopia control glasses, as well as atropine drops to control it from all angles and a higher strength of it. And she's doing really well. Like, you know, she's creeping up max a quarter a year, which is great, you know, rather than a full one diopter or something. But I think if we hadn't done that, she would have been like a minus seven by now, right? Yeah. I've been seeing her for a couple of years now. So, you know, she's doing well, but bottom line is the minus four shouldn't have been there.
No,
you know, could have been. If more parents are aware that what's important is not so much the length of time. I mean, yes, the length of time is important, but the most important thing is the breaks in between. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we have something we call the 20-20-20 rule. Every 20 minutes for 20 seconds, look 20 feet or far away. Mm. So if they, you know, and I always say, think of lifting weights. If you're lifting weights with your arms and, you know, you're exercising, your muscles get tired, right? So you need to drop them for a second and then pick them back up.
Yeah.
And that's the same as our eye muscles. Those are the ones that are flexing.
Yeah.
When you look up close, they actually flex. When you look far away, they actually relax. So it's the same idea. We need to give them a second break. So for myself now, having known that I was suffering from spatial awareness processing disorder, I have now placed my desk next to my window. Mm-hmm. So every little while I just look at it, because you're looking far away then. Otherwise, I'd be looking at a wall right behind me, which is not far away. So if you can just remind yourself, hey, let me just look away, even if it's not exactly 20 minutes, but and tell your children, you don't go from looking at an iPad to going on the computer. That's not a break. You know, I always tell my kids, go get some strawberries from downstairs, or go do this, you know, something quick and easy. Go do something.
Nice. Going back a little bit, because you mentioned like anxiety, you mentioned can't catch a ball, so clumsiness. But some people are anxious and some people are clumsy. So how do you, what's the moment, or what's the one or more defining feature that makes you think, no, this is spatial processing. This isn't, or it's affecting those two things. What makes you think,
what
should people look out for saying, well, maybe it's that, and it's not just the one thing.
Yeah. Biggest thing is, I'm going to say crowds. So you're even overwhelmed going into Costco. That was a big thing for me. I hate going to Costco. So
there's a lot of reasons to hate going to Costco. And then, you get good deals and all, but
and not wanting to interact with other people. And, you know, I should preface this by saying a change, right? It's a change. So if I was someone who always had the same level of anxiety, then that was me, right? But if there was a change, and also if you notice a change in your life, right, where you are on a screen a little more, that will help you know that things are changing. And not wanting to interact with the people around you, feeling like you've become an introvert, you know, fearing things, that you, and not wanting to engage in driving. That was a big thing that, you know, I would say everyone that I have seen that I feel suffers from this disorder has some form of fear of driving.
Yeah.
So they're navigating new, relying on a GPS, relying on a GPS. That was a warning sign for me. I couldn't remember how to get to my own hairdresser that I had been many times, relying on a GPS all the time. You can't even function without that blue dot, because for familiar areas, you know, like just going down the road.
Yeah. It's a tough one, you know, because I feel like a part of that is we're handing over that function to computers. Like, I don't know if you remember, there was a study done once, and it was on cab drivers in London. And do you remember this? And this was before GPS. This would no longer be true today, right? But their brain function was massively elevated compared to the average person, simply because of their need to navigate through those crazy streets.
Yeah. And that is your parietal lobe, is your navigation center. Yeah. That is your, we can't navigate though. Now we can't go anywhere. And I was like that, Natalie. I would not Like I would just be going somewhere nearby where I knew was 15 minutes away and I would still put it in the GPS. Not because it's habit, it's because I needed that to be secure and feel I knew where I was going, right?
So it's that fear and the change. It's the change.
Yeah.
Okay. That's really
it's the change. It's a change. And you know, this mom that I was talking about earlier, she actually said to me as well, she said, I asked her, so how'd you get to this appointment? And she said, oh, my husband dropped me. And I said, is it because you didn't want to drive? And she's like, yeah. And that exactly was what was happening to me, as I would keep asking my husband to take me places.
Wow. That's profound, right? I mean, and that is like a real change, and it's a loss of independence more than as much as anything else.
For me, it was, I used to call myself a hermit. I want to be at home. And then I couldn't define, like, maybe it's just me getting old, midlife. I kept saying it was midlife. Everyone goes through this, right? This is what people talk about, women going through midlife, you know, maybe I'm perimenopausal. I don't know. But then when it was happening with my kids, there was something wrong with you.
I got you. Okay. So you shared that you were diagnosed with glaucoma at 11.
Mm-hmm.
How did that shape your relationship with your own vision and your sense of safety in the world? It's a big one.
So the good news is, I mean, I haven't lost vision. I was well controlled since I was 11. And, but I think what happened, you know, when I was 11, my parents were told I would go blind eventually, because that's what we knew of it at that time, that disease. We didn't have a lot of research out. And so there was always this fear that I'm going to go blind. And so for me, it was a more positive thing that I need to do everything I can at a very early age. So, I mean, I graduated when I was 23. I was like, I need to complete everything before I go blind, you know?
Oh my gosh.
So for me, it was a motivator, and everybody takes their things life throws at them differently,
100%.
Right? And you know, you can either take it positively or negatively. And for me at that young age, it was like, that's it. I'm going to be an eye doctor and I'm going to do this. I'm going to do it fast and early. And I'm going to, you know, get there and save other people. You know, thankfully I haven't lost vision and everything is good to date. But for me, I'm a strong believer that diseases are not just meant for adults or seniors. They're also meant for children, and we have to screen them comprehensively and make sure. Sure, the volume is not as high in children, but they still have diseases that we have to check them for. And I think it's passed off by too many doctors because they're just a child. They're not going to get it.
Yeah.
And that's, I can't tell you how many kids I see where I'm like, oh my God, you have like, you know, some form of a totally different disease and no one's ever said this to you or no one's told you you had keratoconus. Like there's so many patients like that. And it's sad that we end up being the first person to tell them. I wish, you know, we encourage eye exams starting at 6 months of age. So I wish someone, you know, checked all these things.
Yeah, no, it's very powerful. I mean, I recently came across a couple of articles of very young people who died of, like a teenager died of breast cancer and was sounding the alarm for over a year before anybody would believe her. And by the time they caught it, of course, because she was so young, it was so aggressive that it killed her. So you bring up a really powerful point. And this is not to instill fear in people or to make people neurotic, but I think maybe, especially in the world that we live in now, where the inputs are so different, right? The exposure to artificial light, to screens, to if you believe that non-native EMFs could be a problem for the body, the exposure to toxins and hormones and all this extra stuff, we have to be open to the possibility that even a young person that is more sensitive could potentially have a poor response to something. So I think that's a very powerful statement. And again, not to be taken as something to fear, but just as an added awareness, you know, to broaden that peripheral, that peripheral vision to understand that if there's a sign or just to be more responsive to it. So what did traditional optometry teach you that turned out to be incomplete once you really started paying attention to the brain side? Because you would think that in traditional optometry, they would teach you about the eye and the brain and the whole thing, but there must have been a point of departure where you're like, wait a minute, we missed something, or there's a door here we didn't get through.
I think, you know, I can't remember because it's over 20 years ago, but I can say that either I didn't get enough training or I didn't learn it as well as maybe I should have. But, you know, we learned about all the parts of the body and the brain, and obviously there was all those sections, but we didn't learn about the actual process of everything being like your eye is just the vessel where everything mm-hmm. is going to the brain. So that connection piece was missing. So yeah. for example, the connection of, yeah, but the parietal lobe is actually processing all this stuff. We never learned all that. This is what the parietal lobe does, but that's separate, right? This is what yeah. the temporal lobe does. But where was that connection piece that, okay, but it's connected to the retina because the retina is the one sending that information through the visual cortex. And if you don't get that information, you'll be off balance and you won't have great sense of place and where you're standing and all of those things. So I think it was more that connection piece that was missing, and it was very factual. And I think all, you know, post-secondary schools are like that, where they're just not adding up the pieces for us. Yeah. And then of course, at that time we didn't have screens. That's when I got my first cell phone. So we didn't really have screens.
Yeah.
And so that was never taught, and it couldn't have been. And I think for me, another part of it was the lack of talk of nutrition. But again, I feel a lot of this has come out post the 20 years ago, where we focused on nutrition now for your brain health and therefore your eye health. I do feel a lot of this came out a lot later, but for me, the biggest missing piece was we learned all these in sections, but nothing was connected for us.
Yeah.
And it was up to us to go outside now and do our own research to connect the pieces. Hopefully things are changing, and I think they probably are. And a number is not just a number, right? Like when we were taught in school, okay, you're this prescription, you're this prescription, but what does that mean in everyday life? You know, so what's really happening to the retina, and what does that mean? And those are all things that we had to research on our own now.
Yeah, no, that's just a really good point. I think that integration and not seeing, you know, we see the ear as a hearing piece. We see the eye as a seeing thing. And what you've just been talking about is it so much more. It affects your sense of safety. It affects your sense of your ability to process the information that's coming in, which may affect your behavior, which could get diagnosed as anxiety, which might be a different problem altogether. Like, I think, you know, it's exactly what you're saying. It's connecting the dots. It's creating an ecosystem instead of dealing with just an organ.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that, and we're seeing this across disciplines.
Yeah.
Right? So whether it's translating. I think whether it's translating yet, the problem with a lot of these education systems is they tend to be slow moving, mm-hmm. And not, they're not very responsive. And so then it really comes down to the practitioners to your point, you graduate. Now is when your real education starts and you start to put things together in your own way, which is powerful. You know, like, yeah, it's really,
you know,
powerful.
I encourage all practitioners always that it's not about what you learned in school. Like, you won't have all those tools and you won't have everything in a clinical textbook. You know, for me, I can't stand when a doctor says to me, okay, but let me look it up because it must have been there in that textbook. It's like, no, like, let's
not really.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't have to fit a textbook appearance, right? Not everything has to check the list, right? And that's why even for spatial awareness processing disorder, and we have an SAPD-10, which is a tick box, but I always tell people that it doesn't have to fit that 10, right? You have to know your body, but also I like when healthcare practitioners actually go out there and do research. Like, mm-hmm. if a doctor ever said to me, I don't know, but I'm going to go think about it and I'm going to go research and get back to you, I would love that. I would value that. But why are we as practitioners always in so much fear of not knowing everything? I tell my patients all the time, I don't know about that eye drop, but I'm going to go research it and I'll let you know. Or I don't remember everything. I have one brain. So I can't remember every eye drop and everything. And, you know, we learn about it, we forget about it. But you know, if you give me a minute, I'll call you tomorrow and let you know. And I think that's the care matters. We don't expect every doctor to be brilliant. We expect every doctor to care.
And to be curious. But that's such a good point. That's such a good point. So you've built three practices, mm-hmm. which is a lot. It's a big, you're now dealing with a lot of people. So what did building three practices teach you about the real world gap between eye care and brain care?
Oh my gosh, that's a loaded question. I built three practices because I felt that it was important for me to have, I mean, if I could build 10, I would, I just don't have the capacity, but I felt I needed a place where people can come and be heard, and communication is key for me. So even the doctors working at my clinic, like, they're vetted, and, you know, we make sure that they are communicating, they are talking, they're following up. All my leads, my managers, everybody is phenomenal. I don't think anybody walks into our clinic feeling like they're not heard. And for me, it was, when you come in with an eye problem, I mean, if it's just an eye problem, like an infection, okay, we'll help you with that. But if it's an eye problem beyond that, like, your child is struggling with reading, is being labeled as on the spectrum, mm-hmm. we need to look beyond that, because your vision may be perfect. 90% of the children we see have good vision that are being put on the spectrum. But what else is happening? Is it their muscles are weak and they're getting tired? Kind of like we need to do vision therapy or give them a mild boost to help relax their muscles more. What do we need to do? Or is their brain actually not able to process the vision that they're looking at? And so we need to do that coordination exercises to help them get by. That is what I expect from every practitioner at these clinics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's so powerful. And again, when it comes to, we keep coming back to kids because they're the front line of the people that are suffering the most from underdiagnosing and misdiagnosing of these issues.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I know that there's someone close to me whose little boy is struggling a lot with learning issues at school. And the first thing she was told is she was going to have to put him on medication for mm-hmm. ADD or ADHD. And she's said, no, I need to understand why. And when they took him in for an eye test, they discovered that he could read columns, but he couldn't read across a line. Right. So there's a mechanistic issue that this little boy is having, that somebody was going to throw a drug to dampen his response and wasn't actually going to help him.
Right. And then we can train that, how to get by. I mean, slowly help him improve. But that is so parallel to what I was talking about, that I was going to be put on anxiety meds during my episode because I was getting anxious, scared, not going places. And that was the first answer. Actually, the two answers were pain medication and anxiety medication. Those were the two that I was going to be getting. Luckily, I looked up the pain medication and I saw, like, one of the common side effects was, you know, something in the brain. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm not going on this. It was just like, you know, I'm sure a lot of people taking it's okay, but I was like, you know, I cannot do this. I need to figure this out for myself. I'm not going on the two meds. I can't tell you, Natalie, since I have figured this out myself and trying to practice, you know, more mindfulness and all this to help build my spatial awareness, I haven't had an anxiety attack in 2 years.
Yeah. No, it's whereas the meds eventually would have might have stopped working and you might have been stuck with anxiety and you wouldn't have, like, it's I mean,
there's,
again,
you know, I'm not going to say that.
Yeah, what I was going to say. I was going to say, you know, sometimes in podcasts like these, we can be flippant, and there's a population of people that will benefit from anxiety meds,
and we see that
for
every
a period
day.
Of time, or pain meds, or whatever meds that have very serious side effects. But sometimes we need those. Maybe we need them to break a loop. Whatever the case may be, I think where the danger lies is when. That's where the treatment stops, right? Mm-hmm. We've suppressed a symptom and we step away saying our work is done, where the conversation needs to go to, now that we've suppressed the symptom, let's work towards finding out what might have been driving that symptom so that we can take that block off and help Absolutely. You to come off. And if people walk away with nothing but that, I think it's an
our
approach. Well, it's an approach that will serve all of us really well, right? Yeah, yeah. I think that it's something that as the CEOs of our own health, which is a scary concept to some people, and it's a big responsibility, but truthfully, and you and I living in Toronto, we live in a medical system that I have firsthand experience now, and I'm sure you've seen it, is on the struggle bus, and I'm being generous because mm-hmm. I really think it's broken.
We've all been dismissed and you know, we all feel it, but it's parallel to that 4-year-old girl. I mean, I can control myopia with glasses, or, you know, want to call it medication, drops, whatever, as much as I can. But at the end of the day, if she's always going to get the iPad, there's still going to be some increase, right?
Yeah, so it's not going
to stop. So there has to be not only medication or treatment, but lifestyle changes. And diabetics, we say the same thing. We can put you on metformin and insulin, but if you're going to keep, you know, not exercising and having, you know, 30 cakes a day, your sugar's going to still go up. And we're going to have to add more medication. So there has to be both going in tandem for a lot of people.
Most skincare is like patchwork. Hydrate this, smooth that, maybe brighten a little. But a lot of it is all very surface level. Now, I have a product to talk to you about today that is different. Vita Zero Age Exosomes from Vitali feels more like a system upgrade for your skin. What's unique here is what they call regenerative stacking. You've got zero-age mesenchymal stem cell exosomes acting as the messengers, paired with GHK copper to support rebuilding the skin's structure. Then they layer in niacinamide and glutathione so that you're also supporting barrier and oxidative stress. This formula is designed to help remind your cells how to function more optimally. I've been super impressed by how this product works and feels. Now, if you want to try it out for yourself, all you have to do is go to vitaliskincare.com and use code NAT20 for 20% off. All right, let's get back to our main track here because we keep wandering off, which hopefully is entertaining to people and educational. You have a mental model for how, like in your own mind, you have a mental model for how vision influences cognition, emotional regulation, and stress physiology. Like you've talked about this now. You've talked about how your vision fundamentally affects how you learn, how you regulate your emotions, how you manage your stress. Like, is there a mental model for this? Is there something that people can say, can check in with themselves and say, this might be something I need to check out?
I think that if you feel overwhelmed,
it's that overwhelm, right?
It's that overwhelm. And you feel, I want to say the number one thing people come to me and say is I feel off.
Because
that off word is something is not right, right? You're feeling groggy, off. Like, I mean, I do have a lot of patients who experience more vertigo or vestibular issues because, you know, your cognition is off and they think it's vision, but off is the number one word that everybody says, I feel off. And then if I probe, they'll say, sometimes I feel dizzy. Sometimes I feel like the world is moving. Sometimes I feel, you know, overwhelmed in life. And then I have to keep probing to say like, what's changed? What's happening? What are your symptoms? But if you feel something, then only, like you said, you're the CEO of your own health. You know that there's something off cognitively or emotionally. And yes, you can see somebody like a therapist or whatnot, but at the end of the day, you know, something needs to change in your life to take control over that brain of yours.
Yeah. I love that. You talk a lot about, and you've talked about how the world gets flatter, like flat living. What does that do to your nervous system over time? Is that a little bit like the periphery?
That's exactly what it is. Yeah. It's, you know what, for me, I mean, it came from my book title, Stuck in a Flat World, because all the screens are flat. You know, they're 2D, they're still, they're sitting there, they're flat, and they're close to us. So we are, we're stuck in that flat foveal central vision that is being signaled by your central nervous system.
Yeah. Right. And so then it can adapt when you're out in the real world, and that causes that nervous system dysregulation. So if somebody's wanting to protect cognitive aging, and let's face it, who doesn't, why should they care about peripheral vision and motion tracking specifically? Like
because your peripheral motion or movement and spatial movement and periphery is all processed by the big lobe of your brain, which is your parietal lobe, that is sending signals to other parts of your brain. And if you're not processing that, it's going to get weak. You're going to, you know, have movement issues, you know, feel off balance. You know, a lot of elderly people, you know, wobble, they can't walk. It's not always because of your knee muscles and your hips and all of that. Sometimes that risks us for fractures as well. So it's very important to keep all aspects of our vision stimulated. So cognitively, all areas of our brain are stimulated and alert as we get older. And, you know, I do want to share a story that's a bit of a flip of it, but I have a patient who came to see me, and she came with her son, and he was dismissing her. Like, I was almost uncomfortable in the exam, because anytime she wanted to say something, he goes, "That's okay, whatever. It doesn't matter. She doesn't know what she's talking about." She just says, and I'm like, "Okay, can you read the letters?" And I'm asking her, and she was trying, but he just kept dismissing her, telling her to stop. And
wait, she's having the eye exam and he's dismissing her?
He's with her. Yeah. And he kept telling, so I felt very uncomfortable, but it, you know, he kept trying to tell me that she has Alzheimer's. So then I got a little bit kind of upset in the middle, and I said, "So has she been diagnosed with Alzheimer's? Like, is this why you're cutting her off while I'm telling her to read the letters and all of this stuff? She's been diagnosed with it?" And he's like, "No, she went to do, you know, some testing, and they said she did not have Alzheimer's, but I'm convinced she has Alzheimer's." And I'm like, "Okay, well, let me complete it. She couldn't read the letters. She couldn't figure it out. This, she would kind of segregate the letters." And he kept dismissing her. And he said, "See, this is how she ignores us." Like, he was like all in there, right? It was very uncomfortable for me, because I'm like, I don't think I would ever speak to my mom like that. But, you know, God help me if I would. But
well, you're seeing almost a pattern of elder abuse at that point.
Yeah. Like, and it was very uncomfortable. We ended up running a visual field test on her, which tells us how much visual field, like the periphery, she has. She actually has only, I think it was about like 13 degrees of vision. She actually doesn't have any vision.
Outside of 13 degrees.
Yes. And so she ended up having severe glaucoma that, you know, I was seeing her for the first time, but she ended up, I guess, all these years had severe glaucoma. No one knew about it, but that impacted severe glaucoma, you know, kills your peripheral vision. So she only had central vision. She was cognitively off because she wasn't processing her side vision. So what they thought was Alzheimer's was actually a visual symptom that was giving responses of Alzheimer's. And I'm sure she had a combination of both a little bit.
Well, but at that point, yeah.
I had to explain to him, like, she's not ignoring you. She's not bumping into things. She's not being rude or any of that. She actually can't see you. So she's relying on her hearing. And then he's like, "Oh, but she wears hearing aids." And I'm like, "Okay, well, that on top of it, she also has no hearing, right?" So, you know, you're dismissing her for no reason. She actually doesn't have all these abilities that you and I have. Anyways, I ended up pulling her license, which was the saddest moment of my life, because that was probably the only independence that she had in life, to be away from, you know, her son who was like that. And I had to pull her license because, you know, I said to him, I go, "That could be my child biking on the road behind her when she backs out. And I can't let mm-hmm. that happen." But, mm-hmm. you know, it's just so impactful. The two run in tandem. Your cognitive abilities will decline if your periphery is declined, and vice versa.
Wow. Whoa. We need to talk to him. We need to get her away from him. My heart breaks for that woman. That is so sad. And I mean, yeah, that's just so incredible. That is such a sad story. I mean, thank God she saw you. And they got some clarity, but yeah, that is just really tough. So can you tell us what you think is the most underestimated driver of, I guess, SAPD? Is it near focus, posture, lack of optic flow, lack of real world movement, constant attention interruption? Like, do you have, I mean, it's the screens, like overuse screens has got to be the
above. Yeah. You know? Yeah. But the staring at a near thing up close, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, if you're a constant book reader, I'm going to say the same thing to you, you know.
I was going to say, but are books less bad, or are they?
So, you know, they build imagination, but the problem is they're still not stimulating the peripheral awareness, right? So if you are someone who, yeah, like, I find people definitely give more breaks. Like, they'll look up for a second even. If I call my kids when they're reading a book, they will look up at me. But if I call them, if they're looking at a screen, they're not going to look up at me, right? Because of that dopamine hit. So I think if you're looking at something flat up close all day, that's the biggest driver for me. And then lack of optic flow, you know, movement and moving your eyes around to get that full movement, your body, your eyes, you want that blood flowing all different areas, and you want your vision expanding in terms of visual field. We take our visual field for granted. Yes, we have conditions like glaucoma that kill our visual field. But when you are someone without glaucoma that has a great visual field, we take it for granted.
We take it all for granted. Listen, there's the best part of getting sick is getting better and realizing, right? Having that appreciation. So given that CAPD is a neuroadaptive shift, adaptive being the operative word, rather than a disease, what does that imply about reversibility and what time window matters? Look, you have that little girl who clearly, like, if it keeps going like this, there's not going to be any room for improvement. But for the rest of us, if it's been a couple of years or whatever the case may be, talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, your brain is neuroplastic, right? So nothing is lost. Nothing goes away and stops functioning. It's not atrophied, you know, unless there's a condition there. So you can build just like your muscle. It's like saying, you know, if you not gone to the gym and built muscle for 3 years, you can still go start, right? It's the same idea. So you can build it at any time. There's no time limit that I think that there is. And what's important is starting with small things, small shifts. And the biggest one I would say is your breaks. And the second biggest one is movement without your phone.
Well, going for a walk
without a phone, right? I mean, something as simple like that. I mean, there's so many in my book, we talk about so many things, but I tell patients do basic things like walking without a phone. How many people do I see out in the summers walking, but with their phone? That completely
and staring at their phone.
Yeah. You know, walking their dog with, oh, I got my morning walk, but it completely defeats the purpose. There was a trend on TikTok called the color walk trend. It's one of the rare things that I appreciated from TikTok. And it was pick a color and then go for a walk. And of course, you can take a picture of these colors that you see on your walk. So if you pick blue, you see a blue flower, a blue sign, take pictures, and then they posted reels. But for me, that was powerful because that was expanding your spatial awareness. You're picking and looking outside at what's blue on your walk rather than staring steady at your phone. And I think those are important things. For me, I do things like leave my phone upstairs, and I'm lazy to go upstairs to get my phone. So I'll purposely leave it upstairs so that I don't have to look at it. And my son, he's 10, and he'll always remind me at night, like we talk in bed and he'll say to me, put your phone down. And he'll stare at me and he'll give me the stare. And, you know, that makes me feel bad. So, you know, he's really helped me overcome this, but he will stare at me like, what's wrong with you? Why would you not want to talk to me? And, you know, and that I feel, you know, sometimes our children teach us to be better people, better parents, have more patience. And that really helps me.
Yeah. I love that. I love that your son, the kids are the most draconian task driver. When they get on a thing, good luck to you. Cause they don't negotiate. Like they're actually the best at getting what they want. Okay. So let's recap for people because I'm going to move on to a different section here. But if you were to design the perfect modern workday to be iBrain compatible, you've talked about this already. There was the 20/20/20 rule. What are the non-negotiables? What is it people need to know here? Like, I mean, even set a timer. I don't care. Like what should people be doing?
So first of all, looking at the light in the morning, set your circadian rhythm so that you are awake for the day. I mean, if you're working, for me, a big thing is going to work if you can, because you are going to naturally take breaks and meet people. When you are on your computer, taking those breaks, if you want to set a timer, sure. If you're someone who's on their phone a lot, there are modes on your phone that you can use in terms of, it's really annoying, but it's like a nearness mode. You can set it for your kids, right? And it tells you if you're too close, right? So it helps to bring your phone back. It's super annoying, but if you are someone that cannot put it down, then that will help you. But use those modes. Check your screen time limits or check your screen time. You'll shock you. I think I'm at 7 hours a day. You know, it'll shock you when you look at it, right? And then that will help you bring it down. Like have an inner competition. Position your desk near a window is huge, not only to get sunlight, but to look far away when you are. And at nighttime is 1 to 2 hours before going to bed, keeping away from the phones, setting a you know, and if you have to be set a nighttime mode, wear blue light glasses to help your circadian rhythm, like whatever you want. But for me, when you're again stimulated by a flat up close 10 degree thing, you're going to sleep, not working your peripheral vision, which to me is not a great, very helpful thing.
And there are eye exercises, right? Do you talk about those in your book? Like, I know that, you know, I will tell you a funny story that my husband's dad, who passed away years ago, at a quite advanced age, but he had Parkinson's disease. But I joke with my husband because they all thought his dad was wildly eccentric. And I actually think he was one of the first biohackers on the planet, even before Dave Asprey. Don't anybody tell Dave. Because this man did not believe in wearing glasses. He had read a book. And in this book, it was the book, a very early work of someone you probably know the name of, whose name escapes me right now. And in this book, this man talked about that if you did these eye exercises, you could avoid, and this is long before screens were a thing, but this man was a lawyer. He was an avid reader. He read five papers in the morning, like the whole nine yards, right? And he would sit at the breakfast table and have a hand over one eye and be doing all these crazy eye exercises with one and the other and the other. And they made fun of their dad. And I said to them one day, I'm like, you know, I don't think your dad was so crazy. And he would not go to an eye doctor to get glasses. He would go to Sally Ann and try on glasses just for driving because it was on his driver's license until he found one that was mildly acceptable. And that's what he would wear. But is there, do you think there's, I mean, it's not going to save your vision completely, but do you think there's anything to that?
There are different prescriptions too. Like, so again, like the biohackers that say we're going to solve you and get rid of your minus four, please don't believe that. But in general, there are different prescriptions. Like if you're farsighted a little, or you have presbyopia, which is near, you know, vision issues with the flexibility of muscles, there are eye exercises that can help delay it, or, you know, prevent it or slow it down, or whatever, reverse it. But we're not talking about plus sixes. We're talking about plus ones or minus ones. We're talking about mild prescription. So yes, we can, the muscles can do a little bit. You know, how much is dependent on the muscles will fix, but how much is dependent on the shape of your eyeball or the length of your eyeball? We cannot physically change it. They're not pieces of plastic we can mold and change. But so there's two components to our prescription. One is more the shape of our eye and the length of our eye, and a little bit is our muscle ability. And so that aspect we can help with vision therapy or vision exercise. And we do exercises, especially on children, you know, to help with that. So, you know, he's not crazy in doing exercises, but what he's probably doing is helping to fix a plus one, which is mild, right? Is he helping to fix a plus six? No, but I can say that studies and countless studies have been done, mainly out of China, showing that under correction, especially for nearsightedness, is a stimulus to progression.
So he would have said the opposite. He would have said, the more you wear glasses, the weaker the muscles get.
And that's such a myth. It's such a great myth that's out there. A lot of people say that to me coming in. There have been so many studies that have debunked that. And well, first of all, if you're minus three, you're going to be blind. You're legally blind. You can't even drive. So please do not be driving. And I will be the first to pull your license. But, you know, a minus three should not be on the road. And you need
glasses,
right? So I mean, if you're even able to drive without glasses, then that just tells me you have a mild prescription. And so yeah, exercises can help with that, depending on the core reason for that little prescription being there. So, you know, for me, it's about, again, it's not about what a textbook wrote. It's like, hey, let's try it and see, because you never know.
Let's talk about dry eye a little bit, because it's a big, big problem. So in your clinic, when dry eye shows up, how often are you saying, yeah, this is just, you're not making enough tears, versus a systems problem like sleep, stress, hormones, their lifestyle, staring at a screen for too long? I mean, obviously that's just a question, but is there a distinction to be made there? Because dry eye as a category is just
everything.
It's a big thing, right? It's a catch-all.
For me, dry eye is always for a reason. So every single person that says, yeah, I feel dry. It's part of our questionnaire. We ask every single person, do they feel dry? And if they tick yes, then we are going to ask them all these questions, which is your screen time. Do you have a humidifier at home? Where do you work? Are you in the basement? Are you, well, and if they're 40 plus, generally women, we'll talk about hormones, perimenopause, are you blinking enough? Do you sleep with your eyes open a little bit? You know, we'll talk about all of that, right? I actually sleep
What about hydration?
Hydration, that's a big factor for children. So I'll always say, well, when mommy gives you that water bottle, do you finish that water bottle when you come home, right? By the time you're home. And a lot of children will say no. Hydration is the number one cause of, for kids, dryness and also my high headaches. So a lot of kids will come to me and say, I have a headache. So my pediatrician told me to come to you, and I'll say, well, let's talk about how much water you're getting. Oh, not much. Yeah. Okay. Well, we got to get the water in. So dry eyes, there's a reason your eyes are dry. Our job is lifestyle wise to probe. And then our second job is to look at your glands and see what is not being produced. Is it the water aspect? Is it the oil aspect? Mostly it's the oil in most people. And so the oil comes from our meibomian glands, which are on our waterline or our lash margins. And that oil used to stick with our tears, or a watery component of our tears, for it to stay on our eyes and lubricate our eyes. When the oil is not being produced as effectively, then we get very watery tears. So a lot of people will say to me, I have watery eyes, not dry eyes. I'll say, okay, but that is dry eyes, because nobody wants watery lotion. Everybody wants sticky lotion. Watery lotion.
You want the oil, the emulsifier. Yeah. So what stops the oil from being produced?
So many things. So, I mean, you could have an inflammatory condition. So an autoimmune condition can definitely suppress that. But also menopause, right? We'll see a lack of production there. But more often it's not even a lack of production. It's a blockage of the glands. So the glands tend to get blocked as we get older in all of us. If you looked at mine, they would be a bit blocked. Like everybody gets blocked over time. We have nanoparticles all in the air. And before hitting your eye surface, those glands are the ones that protect it from going into our eyes. Dust, dirt, wind, everything all goes right into those little glands. And over time, by the time we're 40, 50, 60, they're blocked. And think of them as little toothpaste tubes that get filled with stuff in it.
So what do we do? Can we squish them? Can we clear them?
You should not do that. I mean, there are different options. So what I like to start with in mild dry eyes or mild blockages is moist heat masks tend to help. So the moist heat targets those meibomian glands that can help, you know, soften it. So eventually it just comes out on its own. But in a lot of cases, when it's advanced, severe, moderate, we will do procedures like radio frequency or intense pulse light to help. And then we'll squeeze that stuff out like a toothpaste tube. And that has been really effective. So I think finding the reason, both lifestyle wise and both anatomically, are two things that we need to do. And dry eyes is such a disease that is passed off. And I have a patient who's like 76, and just this past, I think it was December, you know, I asked her, and I don't know what in me said to her, like, she comes to me for dry eyes. We've had treatments and all this, and she was getting better. And she said to me, I think about my dry eyes all the time. And I looked at her, and I knew she had anxiety. I remember her telling me that. And I said, is that a cause of your anxiety? Like, do you think about it that much that you get anxious? And she said, yes. And I go, oh my gosh, like, I felt like I had failed the system. I cannot believe that her dry eyes was that severe to her, that it was causing a mental health issue. And we were like on top of it. And, you know, I'm still, it's funny because she books in for just talking to me, you know, and
You're not a therapist, though.
I feel like I'm a therapist on the side. I should have switched professions. I always tell everybody, but you know, I really felt like, I mean, we've been treating her dry eyes, but I don't know if I took her as seriously until she said that to me. And that was a really sad moment for me, that we pass these diseases off, not pass them off, but we don't always realize the impact it's having on someone's life. Something like dry eyes can be debilitating for someone. You know, we've seen those horror stories of people with severe dry eyes that end up, you know, taking their own life. And it's really sad.
Wow. Wow. Okay. All right. Let's flip gears. We're going to start to wrap up in a minute. I'm worried about your children.
We have two now. Not going to lie.
If a longevity listener wants data, because that's what people are looking for. They're looking for data. What can we actually measure today that will correlate with eye brain resilience?
Wow. That's a powerful question. So I don't want to say number wise, you know, in terms of cognition. But what I will say is data for us is certain scans that we can do, retinal scans. So yeah. For us, you know, we have an optical coherence tomographer, or an OCT machine for short, that we do on our patients, where it shows the retinal layers, and retina is, like I said, embryonically brain tissue, and we can detect, and you'll see a lot of studies coming out about this now, early cognitive and neuro diseases based on your retina early. And I think there was just a recent study done where it's showing it even earlier than it's showing brain changes. Wow. So, you know, I think that is data in itself to show changes cognitively prior to you having symptoms. And from that, I'm going to say, I encourage annual exams. I encourage these, you know, these tests. We go to dentists and we will not bat an eyelash for an x-ray in case we have a mild cavity, you know, but the moment people come to an eye doctor for these extra scans, they think it's a money grab. It's not a money grab. Like, we pay so much for these machines, and it's like, we do it for prevention, for preventative health, and we don't have to do the scans. I don't care. You know, if I have to do a scan, it takes me longer actually to read the scans, interpret the scans, actually more liability. I almost prefer not doing the scans if we're talking about for me, but doing it is so important for me on the flip side, because I am able to see so much more than I could just visually with these scans that can be early predictors of not only cognitive health, but systemic health, early blood pressure, cholesterol plaques. So many eye doctors will tell me that we have found cholesterol plaques in blood vessels of the eyes through these scans and prevented a stroke for patients countless times. I can tell you, it's happened to me so many times where I've
unbelievable
felt great because I prevented a stroke. Yeah. And you know, please know it's not a money grab. It is literally for prevention. And it's because we cannot see the layers of all your retina, you know, all the layers of your retina. We cannot see that deep. We don't have x-ray vision, and we can miss things.
Well, and the other thing is, I think what's important is you need baselines. You know, when you see plaque in someone's, in the blood vessels in someone's eyes, which is, I mean, people don't think of it, right? The eye is so vascular. There's so many blood vessels in there. And so it would, and they're tiny, so they can't tolerate a lot of plaques. So it, to your point, it could be like an early warning signal, sign. But if you have someone who you've seen for 10 years and all of a sudden you know that those blood vessels are clear and all of a sudden they're not, you're like, you got to go back to your doctor. Like,
yeah,
there's a problem. And that's so powerful. And that, you know, and it starts to create this holistic integrated approach to health that acknowledges that every system is fundamentally bound to the next one. It's not just the brain to the eye. It's the brain, the eye and the brain to the heart, to every other system in the body. And that's just so, I don't know. It's the reason why you're part therapist. It's all part of the whole.
You can talk to me anytime, Natalie.
Yeah, I know. Listen, I'm coming in. I'm coming in hot, maybe in the summer because you're too far for the winter. All right. So if you were designing a research study to validate SAPD as a lifestyle-driven pattern, I mean, I think by now
people, and we are designing one, so yes,
you are. Yes, well, there you go. So, what are you going to be measuring, and over what? How long do you think it needs to be measured over, and what are you going to be measuring?
So, I think we're working out all the details, but I think for us, it's a lifestyle-driven pattern.
Yeah,
and for us, it's more about what patients are experiencing and symptoms. So, it is going to be in the format of likely a questionnaire where we're measuring how much screen time, how much, you know, people are spending on a near device or a near thing aspect. Like, we're breaking it down into all different things because it's not just a screen, but how much outdoor time are they getting? All different aspects and age groups, and breaking it down really into a questionnaire after that. And I think for me, this is a big thing coming out in the next year or two, where we're starting designing it already. And I think this is going to be a big driver for people to just wake up and realize that we know screens are bad. I mean, we all know that, but how bad they are and how balanced it needs to be is ridiculous.
Well, and can we help people to understand the consequences, really, and confirm them, right? Because there's so much noise out there. Okay, so let's get into a couple practical things people can do. If parents can only change three things this month, what would have the biggest impact on spatial development and learning for their kids?
Wow. Three things. Okay. Besides, like, you know, obviously the obvious, you know, cutting down our screen time, and depending on your age group, if you're under six, like you want to lower that to under an hour okay. under a day. Yes, please.
Right. Yeah. No, if you can give people benchmarks,
if they're 6 to 12, you know, 2 hours is generally our limit. And after that, up to parents to figure out with their schoolwork and stuff. But 6 to 12, generally 2 hours is the limit, and broken up every 20 minutes, right? No night scrolling. That's going to be another one for me, is letting them have their phones at bedtime. So having those screen-free zones that we talk mm-hmm. about, whether it's the dinner mm-hmm. table or bedtime, those are big things. And parents can demonstrate, lead by example. And outdoor time. So many studies have shown that outdoor time helps with everything, but also yeah. our vision, our sight. And studies have proven sight changes and things getting better or not progressing or delayed onset of prescriptions with outdoor time. And there was a study out of China that actually had the 2 hour mark came from good studies. And there was a study that showed an extra half an hour, like a 1.5 hours versus 2 hours. So an extra half an hour of recess for a certain group of kids helped delay that onset. Like, so 2 hours was that benchmark of outdoor time. Hence why my kids are outside in the backyard in a storm. But yeah. no,
but fine. It's not, it's actually, it's a warm
storm. I'm not a bad mom. I'm going to have like,
this was a warm storm. We're just around zero. It's actually, I mean, people in Florida are freaking out, but anybody in Minnesota is like, oh, please, if it's around freezing, it's like spring. And so what role should schools be playing? Like, if they actually had any awareness of eye brain development, which would be a stretch, but you know, in your perfect world, what would schools be doing differently if they were plugged into this whole
breaks of their screen time, you know? Yeah. 'Cause I know with my kids, we talk a lot about, like, I mean, they're not very clear with me 'cause they're young, but a lot of times they're like, oh, we're sitting on this iPad all day. And they also read on the iPad, you know? And I'm like, go get a book from the library, you know? So for me, it's taking these breaks. So consciously, if you have a period of 20 minutes where they're on a screen for, I don't know, tech class, it's like, make the next period something about distance vision where we're writing something on the board. Consciously try to, in an ideal world, that's what I would do. Those would be my breaks. So you're not constantly staring up close. You know, nowadays I see even like their French class has apps. They're on yeah. French apps all the time, right? Yeah. And for me, it's like, okay, but that's not how we learned French. It's looking at the words, writing them, looking at the pictures. Okay, this is this, and speaking it, right? So it's so different. So, I mean, but again, I tell my kids, I don't want you to fall behind. I don't want you, like, this is the new tech age. So yeah. I don't want to eliminate devices. Please, I hope nobody takes that from this conversation. I'm on my device. My kids are on devices. We're not talking about elimination. We're talking about screen balance. And yeah. that is the biggest thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk to me about food. How do we feed our eyes?
How do we feed our eyes?
Well, there's got to be, right? I mean,
yeah,
there's
yeah. There's, you know, that's where the carrot myth came from, right? So yeah. we talk about
carrot myth. Can we blow that up right now?
So we talk about lutein and zeaxanthin, right? Yeah. Those are the carotenoids that supplement our macula and our retina. And we get those in colored vegetables. So we're talking about kales, broccolis, red peppers, the colored stuff. And that's where the carrot myth came from. We actually don't get a lot of it from carrots. So you don't have to eat carrots per se, but these other darker vegetables are generally better. And also the berry class, right? Great for mm-hmm. antioxidants, great for your eyes, and omega-3s. So yeah. really good for dryness, dry eyes, and brain health, as you know. So those would be the three things, and you can get them naturally through your foods that I would tell. Those are the only three things I urge patients. So I had a patient who was 40 something, which is very early to have macular degeneration. She actually came to me for a second opinion saying, I don't believe I have macular degeneration. I'm 40. And I look it up online and it's for like 60-year-olds. And I looked at her, I go, you have like severe macular degeneration. Like she's actually very young to have it. And we talked about diet. That was the number one thing that we talked about. And I actually did give her a supplement. So she's one of those people where, yes, you need a supplement because you're already
too so far gone.
Yeah. But also I need you to change your diet. And we talked about what she eats, and she's nowhere in that class of eating vegetables and all that stuff. So we talked about making a big salad and incorporating that and omega-3s and all this stuff. So I think, and being a non-smoker is huge. So smoking can accelerate. I think the risk is like 2.6 times higher rates of a lot of eye diseases because of smoking, especially macular degeneration.
Wow. A couple of quick fire things and you get to go rescue your children. What's the most popular eye health belief you think is oversimplified or flat out wrong? And you've already blown carrots out of the water. So you need
I can't use that one. Oh my God. That glasses are bad.
Yes. Good. Yeah.
If you don't wear your glasses because you're a -3 and you decide I'm not going to wear my glasses and I'm going to be legally blind. I do have patients that say this to me. Okay, fine. Especially with parents with their children. But imagine how much brain power you are using to see that world. And then these are the children that are going to grow up with early Alzheimer's, early dementia, early cognitive diseases. I mean, we've already seen there's a paper in the Globe and Mail, I think recently, early Parkinson's, 30s and 40s already we're seeing. So please wear your glasses so you can relieve your brain. Sorry, I had to blow that
up. I love it. When people say it's all about artificial blue light, what do you think they're missing about attention, near focus, and nervous system load?
Oh my gosh.
So much.
It's a whole other podcast. I want to blow all that up. I want to blow it all up. Listen, blue light scientifically is the shortest wavelength of visible blue light. And because it's the shortest wavelength, it has the highest energy. So it tends to scatter the most. That is the problem with it, right? So when you're looking at a screen all day, you might get fatigue and stuff because you're staring at something up close all day. So your muscles are tired. But if you want to blame it on the blue light, sure, it's just because it scatters more. So out of all visible light, that's the one that scatters more. So if you want to wear blue light glasses, great, go for it. But is it going to help all your near focus and your muscles that are tired from sitting up close on a computer all day? No. But is it going to ruin your circadian rhythm at night? Yes.
Okay. Do you have an opinion on red and near infrared light for eye health?
I do. So, you know, we have a lot of research coming out on it. I don't know if I'm a fan of it for myopia control yet. I want to see more research on that, but it has started. There have been a lot going on, but I don't know if I would do red light therapy on my children for myopia control. But for retinal, you know, to stimulate the mitochondria, and we're mitochondria rich in the retina, you know, we are starting to see studies out on the increase in contrast and definition of patients who have macular degeneration and other eye diseases, retinal diseases. So we are starting to see a lot of positive things come out of it. Great. Would I be telling every patient to go get it? No. But if a patient has advanced macular degeneration and is starting to lose contrast, definition, vision, do I think it's a good idea? Yes. With an approved device for the eyes, not a full, you know, there's different wavelengths we talk about for the infrared, especially. You don't want to go too high. So an approved eye device, you know, 3 to 5 minutes, 3 times a week. Great.
And so for people who have these red light panels, let's say, should they be wearing something to block the light or just close their eyes? Will they get any benefit through their eyelids?
Not really. It won't penetrate.
You wouldn't stare at it, but could you look away kind of thing? And
I don't know if I would look away because you would still get it from the sides, but I would wear most of these full body panels should come with goggles, right? Yeah. That I would just wear those to avoid the risk of it going through, you know, tangentially. But the ones that are approved just for the eyes will obviously not have goggles. Right. They will be approved for the eyes.
Okay. What's the helpful language versus fear-based messaging when we're talking about screens and kids to parents? Because we've talked about this a lot today. And I think you're a very empathetic person. And I think you've been very careful not to try not to scare the crap out of people. But if you could leave parents with that message, that final message for today about their children and screens, do you want to maybe articulate it one last time?
I'm going to bring it back to what you mentioned, empathy. So thank you for that. But, you know, if we don't balance the screen time or the near device time, we are not only going to lose, you know, cognitive ability and motion and get anxiety and crowd fear and become an introvert, but we're going to lose a big piece of childhood that helps us develop as an adult, which is spatial empathy. And that's a big piece we talk about in our book is spatial empathy comes from this parietal lobe as well. And that's why we are seeing kids that are not as empathetic. They'll bump into each other and not even say like, oh, I'm sorry. And, you know, I think as a parent, our biggest thing is we want our kids to be good people. And we are stimulating them with something up close that's going to make them lose all these other personality factors, not develop to the fullest ability. And we're not going to see it now. We're going to see it when they're teenage late years and we're going to blame ourselves for it.
Yeah. And the hormones are raging and then it really gets ugly. All right. So in your upcoming book, Stuck in a Flat World, what do you most want the public to understand that medicine hasn't quite caught up to yet?
I want them to understand that the brain has so much going on and processing from your vision, through your vision, and what steps you can take practically in this world. You know, we talk a lot about the practical steps. So we don't talk about, don't use screens. It's not practical.
Tell me what to do.
Yeah. What to do and how to do it and just how to effectively live and get rid of certain things like withdrawal symptoms, anxiety symptoms, better sleep, all those things that are all being affected by this parietal lobe. And I just want people to live their best life through this book.
I love it. I can't wait. I can't wait to get my hands on it. All right. A couple of quick fire questions and we're out of here. One symptom that makes you say, stop scrolling and get evaluated. Just one, really quick.
Headaches.
A daily habit that gives the biggest return for eye brain longevity.
20/20/20 rule.
The most underrated biohack for vision that costs $0.
Morning sunlight.
A question you wish every doctor asked patients about screens.
How often are you on it?
Yeah. A sign someone's dry eye is actually a systemic stress signal.
They can't stop thinking about it. It's too often.
Yeah. They're obsessed with it. Yeah. The one sentence you want listeners to remember about cognitive aging and vision.
They're so closely connected. Don't ignore your eyes.
I love it. This has been fantastic.
You caught me off guard with those.
I know I did, but you did great. And I think we get some of the best information in these last questions because it forces you to distill the information down to a very short. I mean, you've been saying this all along in the podcast. So thank you so much for your time, Dr. Agarwal, and for your work. And I can't wait for your book to come out. So please tell people where they can find you online, your resources they can access, and where they can buy the book when the book is available.
Absolutely. No, thank you so much for your time, Natalie. And you can find me on Instagram. That's probably the easiest way at dr.meenalagarwal, which is my name. You can also find me on drmeenal.com. Forgot my website. That's where we're going to announce our book on both platforms. It's going to be coming out late October. So, you know, people will be able to purchase it then. And then I also have a podcast called Uncover Your Eyes, The Truth About Health and Wellness. So you can find me there as well. But thank you for this. This has been great.
Thank you. This has been fantastic.
Hey folks, just a quick reminder that all of the information presented in this podcast is for information purposes only. No medical advice, no diagnosing, no treatments suggested here. Before you try anything that you hear about or learn about here, make sure that you check with your medical provider.